for the 2002 Whitbread First Novel Award. His second novel, Transmission, came out last year, and it won the Decibel Award in the British Book Awards and was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. And this year, he published a collection of short stories called Noise. In 2003, he was named one of Granta's best young British novelists. And this is just the beginning of the list of the honors that he's received. And he's still modest. Look, that's very good. That's the, yeah. So he gets the modesty prize as well. Harry's going to read for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have a short conversation up here, and then we'll open it out to you, and then carry on. Yes, right.
Go to the pub.
Go to the pub. All right. Please welcome Harry Kunzru.
Thanks all for coming. That's very sort of lulling, gentle sort of theme music we seem to have. I don't know. It's not a very lulling, gentle story that I'm going to read, which is from this kind of cute little penguin book, which is one of their 70th anniversary things, which I sort of took the opportunity to put together a very, very short collection of short stories. So I'm just going to read one of those out, beginning, middle, and end. The story's called Eclipse Chasing. Although we manufacture the eclipse system, we don't make any decisions in regard to its use. That's a matter for the politicians. It's an important distinction, but a terribly hard one to get across. Our position as a company is clear. We feel it's basic good citizenship to do what we do, which is to provide government with the technology it requires to keep people safe. We cherish safety, and are frankly surprised anyone would argue against it. I mean, don't these people have children? Vernon is trying to make this point to a group of protesters from the camp outside the gates. This is not a military facility, he's saying. The protesters are dressed as negated corpses, which I think is rather tasteless. Two butch-looking women have chained themselves to the perimeter fence. The others are chanting slogans and trying to unfurl one of their zero design sensibility banners. I think Vernon is acquitting himself well. He has a very masculine presence and a beautiful voice. Most people would be grateful to have a conversation with such a well-turned-out young man. We are a private company, says Vernon, summoning his most serious expression. We provide the nation with vital equipment as well as fun products for everyday use. Great banner, by the way. Now, I think he's beginning to flounder. Complimenting them never works. One of the things which gets to me about the protesters is that they have no concept of excellence. It's like, unless some deprived Canadian kid can't have it, you can't either. I think that's awful. The shouting increases in volume. There's audible profanity. It looks as if it's going to be time to call in an OBV. I go to the bike and phone broadcast, who say they'll scramble one right away. It's a good thing, because while I'm gone, a COMPRO takes place. COMPRO is a customer response acronym for comestible projectile. They're a depressingly frequent occurrence. I return to find Vernon raising his voice, which is contrary to best practice. He has egg yolk all down his dove grey tunic and is quoting statistics to the protesters about food waste, animal welfare, and early year nutritional deficits in zones of conflict. I wouldn't have bothered myself. Demonstrating these people's hypocrisy may be intellectually satisfying, but it rarely brings results. Overhead, I can hear the rotors of the outside broadcast vehicle. Vernon withdraws from the fence, and we take cover behind the bikes, sealing our helmets before it touches down. Some of the protesters know what's coming and make a run for it. Others choose not to move. The two chained to the fence are, of course, immobilized. The broadcast is quite low level, but you can tell it has an impact. They roll around, retching and spasming. One appears to have passed out. When it's over, we distribute the usual disclaimer notices, reminding the protesters of our legal right to use a broadcast system, our previously established indemnity against claims for physical or psychological ill effects, and so on. If they aren't fully conscious, we just tuck it into their dungarees. To show there's no hard feelings, the pack also includes vouchers, a fragrance tester, and a cartridge featuring some of the great new signings to our entertainment division. The problem we face is that however many times we tell them we're not political, the protesters don't believe us. They insist against all logic that because we developed Eclipse, we hold some responsibility for Calgary and Thunder Bay. It's a point of view which has caused real downward movement on our stock price. And behind the scenes, our lobbyists are pressing government for some kind of tax credit. We've carried the can for Eclipse despite substantial interests in the youth sector, where an association with Eclipse cityscapes negatively impacts volume. That ought to count for something. The altercation with the protesters has made us late. It's time we got back to the hub to participate in this afternoon's opportunity. I capture a few stills for the vlog, mostly dazed protesters holding their information packs, while Vernon dabs at his egg stain with a pre-moistened wipe. "Vernon, dear, you didn't win many hearts and minds in that engagement," I tease. "Patricia," he drawls, "just button it, why don't you?" I hate it when he calls me Patricia, especially on duty. It's so unprofessional. When I tell him this, he points out that addressing your co-workers as dear or Miss Thing is also unprofessional. We rev up the bikes and sulk all the way back to the hub. Though we bicker, Vernon and I are a great team. Customer response is a relatively new field and a challenging one. Candidates with a security background often lack presentational style, and people who've worked in old-fashioned corporate communication are accustomed to producing promos or setting up interviews rather than face-to-face crowd work. For me, it's a perfect combination. I've always been into the gym, and the chance to combine my excellent interpersonal skills with the application of non-lethal force is just fantastic. Vernon feels much the same. He used to be a diving champion. Under that tunic, he still has a great body. In a high-stakes context like Eclipse, there's an armory of PR tools we can bring to bear. One night last month, our landscaping team surrounded the camp at the main gate and, working in complete silence and darkness, planted thousands of daffodils and dwarf pear trees. The logistical challenges were considerable, but it went off without a hitch. The protesters reacted exactly as we'd expected. When they woke up and found themselves enclosed on all sides by attractive flora, they conducted a non-hierarchical decision-making process, something which always takes them ages, and decided the company gardeners must have had some sinister purpose. So they emerged from their yurts and uprooted everything. We recorded the event from a hide and were able to distribute dramatic images of angry hippies trashing trees and flowers. No one likes to see that kind of thing. Several of their queasier backers withdrew support. We roar up to the hub and push the bikes back onto their kickstands. It's busy. As ever, when we have an audience, we make a big performance of taking off our gloves and unzipping the body armor plates from our uniforms. Then we walk fabulously through the crowd, carrying our helmets like astronauts and drawing admiring glances from the news crews. In the vestibule, junior employees are distributing electronic press kits to reporters wearing the latest hair and teeth, who are taking turns recording pieces to camera in front of the water feature. This afternoon's opportunity is particularly busy because a senior government minister is arriving to tour the new Ethics Park. The park project was initiated by Terry, our visionary CEO. The government is keen to highlight the contrast between us and the Canadians, who have no tradition of human rights and follow a cruel and judgmental religion. So ethics are hot, and Terry sees the park as a way to position us to bid for post-war cultural contracts. "We are going to help rebuild Canada," says Terry. "We're going to put in place the edutainment infrastructure they so desperately need." On the dot of three, the minister arrives in a domestically manufactured car flanked by synchronized outriders. She steps onto the red carpet, is greeted by Terry, who dashingly kisses her on both cheeks, waves to the camera, and drops her coat to reveal a stunning lavender evening gown slashed at the thigh. Then she signs autographs for some competition winners and is ushered into the park. Vernon and I are on security detail. We walk either side of the main crowd of dignitaries, maintaining constant contact with broadcast through our earpieces. I love VIP detail. It's that feeling of being part of something. In this case, a tightly controlled network of people, computers, and weaponry. This afternoon, Terry has assembled a fantastic tour party, showcasing our best studio and management talent. The minister is meeting turbo folk stars Jantalia and Ercole, several cast members from Who's Surgery, our head of engineering, and a decorated war hero who single-handedly wiped out a platoon of Canadian Special Forces at the Battle of Salmonon. I would have left out the war hero. During the action, he received 80% burns, and most of his major body functions are assisted by devices in his chair. But Terry has a sure touch, and what the war hero lacks in aesthetics, he makes up for in ethics. Ethically, the war hero is unbeatable. The minister makes conversation. asking Terry about the company's new products and dropping the name of a mutual friend. She tells the war hero he's heroic and asks Ercole about his forthcoming tour. She has been beautifully briefed. As an ethnically diverse ensemble plays a panpipe arrangement of Do Right Woman, Terry leads the way through the entrance to the viewing platform, where the party contemplates a vista landscape to represent the stern but simple world of the ancient Greeks. The park is contained in a climate-controlled dome, which rotates through a complete day and night cycle every 30 minutes. At the centre is the Arch of Decency, which, as Terry tells the minister, stands 20 metres high and is ingeniously formed from a pair of giant naturalistic hands, both holding symbolic objects. The giant hand on the left is clutching the sword of righteous justice, while the giant hand on the right has the trusty shield of fair play. Terry hits a prearranged mark and reels off his speech about the arch, allowing the official photographer to take a picture of him pointing towards it, backed by the company logo. Terry points out that the hands cast a shadow over the park, which moves position every 7.5 minutes, pointing to each of the cardinal points of the compass in turn. He describes the park's 21 zones, each devoted to an important ethical principle: transparency, voluntary consent, full disclosure, equality of opportunity, avoidance of unnecessary mental suffering, and so forth. Each zone incorporates a number of attractions and a pavilion where visitors will be able to purchase themed gifts and refreshments. "I really have to congratulate you," says the minister to Terry. "It's so coherent." Terry nods sagely. "We did a lot of modelling," he tells her. "This particular disposition of resources sat at a notable peak in the fitness landscape." One of the actors interrupts to ask the minister about her jewellery. They've been told only to speak when spoken to, and Terry looks annoyed. The actor realises his mistake and tries to fade away, but it's too late. Terry's PA is already making a note. Unobtrusively, I position myself beside them so as to be able to intervene if there's anything unseemly in the way of pleading or remonstration. Luckily, the actor just pales and stutters something about needing the restroom. I have one of the park staff escort him back to the hub, just in case. The park is a showcase for us because it's been made and project managed completely in-house. From structural engineering through to graphic design, the entire 100-acre site is our work. This is why it's such a calling card. It's common knowledge around the hub that the project isn't intended to break even. Though we're rumoured to be expecting such a huge loss, Terry supposedly foresees an upside of 7 figures. Because with the park, the minister will be unable to deny us the Canadian contracts. It's almost a done deal. We walk through the right to life zone, where the minister is especially taken by the interactive termination. We all have a great time hitting the little pop-up heads with the rubber mallets. It's going fantastically. Every so often, the sky in the dome darkens, thunder rolls, and a giant holographic prophet, played by one or other of our major studio stars, appears and intones a snappy tenet from one of the major world religions. "Thou shalt not kill," growls Jonty Ving, sporting a wonderful beard. "Only eat fish which have fins and scales detachable from the skin," warns Catherine Colostomo, who makes the best of the material but must be looking for a better agent. The minister is enchanted. The trouble comes when we're on the Freedom Train, a dark ride which forms part of the cultural sensitivity zone. At first, everything seems normal. We board small open carriages held snugly in our seats by foam-covered restraining bars. Animatronic figures and video projections tell the story of freedom from the first moment of moral decision through to today's culture of global liberty. We're in a section explaining the importance of governmental protection when I noticed that one of the animatronic terrorists is dressed differently from the others. Over his lumberjack shirt, someone has tied a white bib with the slogan, "Eclipse is evil," written on the front. Before I have time to respond, the train moves on, whirring along the track towards the next tableau. I try to raise broadcast, but I can't get a signal. This makes me nervous. It's possible the ride's controls are interfering with my headset, or perhaps the steel skeleton of the tunnel is acting as a Faraday cage. Either way, I don't like it. I'm no longer part of a network. I can't even confer with Vernon, who's sitting in the rear carriage. I'm at the front, several seats ahead of the minister. It's too dark to see her expression, so it's impossible to tell if she's noticed the security breach. Perhaps the shirt is an isolated incident, one of the technical or maintenance staff making a statement. If that's the case, it will be simple enough to fix. I hope so. When the train comes to a sudden halt, I realise the situation may be more serious. We've stopped beside a large plasma backdrop, which is supposed to accommodate a tableau portraying the origin of the freedom to choose. Yesterday at the technical rehearsal, avuncular figures dressed in period clothing, representing the founders of Safeway, Tesco, Piggly Wiggly and Fnac, sang a song about consumer empowerment while the screen relayed a montage of quaint historical adverts. Now the figures have gone, and the screen is an ominous uniform blue. Several of the tour party realise something is amiss and begin to squirm in their seats. I try to raise the restraining bar, but find it's clamped down tight. With some difficulty, it's possible to twist round, but getting out is impossible. I'm trapped. The minister is trapped. Terry is trapped. I can feel panic rising up in my chest, but my training kicks in, and I force myself to visualise a pyramid located at the innermost centre of my being. Controlling my breathing, I place the panic inside it, where it can do no harm. Then I reach down to my belt and unholster my weapon. Voices murmur in the darkness. The tour party is increasingly uneasy. Terry tries to turn the situation round, joking loudly about whether he really did remember to pay the electricity bill. There are a few muted titters. His PA is frantically hissing into her headset. She also seems to be having communications problems. Vernon, I call out. Everything okay back there? All fine, he responds. I'm about to suggest we try to force the bars when the screen flickers into life. The monochrome blue field is replaced by pixelated grey-black, then by a series of weird, lurching images. The first thing I'm able to make out is a date stamp in the corner, 4 months ago. What happened then? The footage is soundless, below broadcast quality. Someone pans a camera across the ground, jolting it, briefly levelling, then pointing it back at their feet. We're being forced to watch something unedited, something which absolutely should not be there on this screen in this place. I struggle against the restraining bar, but it will not give. It seems to be clamping me even tighter than before, though perhaps that's the panic seeping out of its pyramid. The screen shows a pile of building waste, a fallen wall. Perhaps it's a construction site. The camera jolts around and settles on a sort of twisted black stalk, standing on the rubble like a giant licorice twist. Then I see what it is. The other people on the tour see too. There is an audible groan. The camera is remorseless, zooming in close, forcing us to watch the disgusting sight. I can't tell if it's a woman or a man, but it's still alive, more or less. Its face is a single open sore. What skin it has left is hanging off its body in charred flaps. It takes a faltering step towards us. At the back of the train, someone begins to whimper. Mercifully, the camera jolts again, shakily panning across a landscape that I realised was once a street. Half-melted tangles of reinforcing rods poke up over the rubble. Corpses are everywhere, black streaks scattered over the whiteness like burnt matches. Behind me, Terry is shouting for security. His voice is oddly broken and high-pitched. I find this upsetting in itself. Terry usually has such a mellow tone. Switch it off, he squeaks. Switch it off right now. I'm numb. This is just terrible. The screen flickers and reappears in what must have been an office. A computer keyboard sits incongruously in a pool of liquidized something or other. I don't want to know what. I want to close my eyes. Attached to the keyboard, the fingers welded onto the keys, is a hand. The camera executes a jerky zoom. The hand is wearing a wedding ring. I can hear someone throwing up into the footwell of the carriage behind me. I think it's the minister. Then we're back on the street. Survivors are stumbling around, horribly wounded. A woman carries something small and hideous in a blanket. A little girl cries for her missing hair and teeth. I know where this is now. The news channels showed a few images of Calgary, but they were mostly aerial shots, accompanied by stirring commentary about our victory. But this is the same city. These are the effects of eclipse. Then, as suddenly as it started, the tape stops and the screen reverts to blue. The restraining bars spring up, releasing us from our seats. There's a moment of silence, then everyone begins talking at once. People are hysterical, scared. Most of the actors and singers are in tears. I'm outraged, angry in a way I've never been before. I never realised. It's appalling. Who is responsible? Who could do this? What kind of degraded individual could put us through such a disgusting experience? Turning round, I see the tour party's worried faces bathed in blue light. I call out to see if Terry and the minister have been hurt. Then Vernon and I take our weapons and go to search for the perpetrators. Finally, I understand the kind of people we're dealing with. So far, we've given them an easy ride, but it's time to stop pussyfooting around. Thanks very much.
Harry, you're always have a very, very large canvas. You're always looking at the world, and everything that you write about is there, even when the characters are in a small room in front of a small screen. And you're very engaged with these, with the great moral questions of globalization and so on. But you really know corpocracy really, really well. So I wanted to know how.
I think I have Warwick to thank for that, actually, in a weird way. I came here to do a master's in philosophy and literature, which meant that I was supposed to be thinking about poetry largely, and I was supposed to be thinking about the sort of quite recondite questions of language. But I ended up being far more interested in what was happening down the corridor, and a bunch of people were talking about networks and about various things to do with nonlinear mathematics and all this kind of science and technical stuff, which I knew very little about. Mm-hmm. And it was, I don't know, they were sort of linking technology and philosophy. And when I left Warwick, I discovered that my sole marketable skill in 1993 was that because of hanging out with these people, I knew something about the internet, which at the time was actually relatively rare. It was at a, sort of 2 or 3 years before the big internet boom, and so I started writing articles for newspapers, kind of explaining what this thing was, and eventually got a job on an American magazine called Wired, which I didn't kind of realise at the time. I thought of it as quite a kind of countercultural, sort of edgy magazine, but I gradually realised that I was kind of working for this sort of Californian libertarian business magazine, and they would send me out to the West Coast for what they charmingly termed an injection of Wired DNA. And I would meet these entrepreneurs and various people involved in the software industry. And sit through some very, very weird presentations, kind of things presented to me by business people who believed that they were about to completely change the entire economic system of the world.
And they did?
Or not, yeah. that was my first kind of brush with the world of a kind of sort of self-described visionary corporate elite.
Yes,
and I've been very interested in it in a slightly sort of train crash way ever since.
Well, it certainly leads into my next question, which is about to explain transmission and. If people haven't read the book yet, explain how you advance these.
The title "Transmission" is. I mean, I kind of like titles which you can unpack in multiple ways, and in this case, transmission is obviously. Let's have a bit of Latin. I mean, transmission is from transmittere, to send across, and the sort of primary sending across in the book is a young Indian computer programmer called Arjun Mehta, who grows up in New Delhi, and the border that he crosses is the border to America. He wants to go, and he's always dreamed of becoming a software engineer in Silicon Valley, which he's visualized as this sort of land of milk and honey. And he finally gets his wish, and he gets to go out and work there, and discovers that it's a rather harder business living in California than he'd imagined. And he's occupying a very kind of marginal position in this world. He's on a very restrictive visa. He has to work under quite difficult conditions, and he's not being paid what he was told he was going to be paid. And this is a situation which, especially in the late 90s, which is when this book is set, it's a pre 9/11 setting for this book. It was very, very common for US companies to be kind of sucking up developing world technical talent in that way. So Arjun's been sent across to America, and he's in a precarious position, and he's working for an antivirus company. He's told he's going to lose his job, and he's so desperate to keep it that he decides to make some work for himself, and how he does that is by unleashing various computer viruses, and you know, he thinks that he'll be able to step in and save the day, and that will be all good. And of course, it being a novel, this is a disaster, and Arjun ends up as a non-driver on the run in California, and this. The effects of the computer virus bring in all sorts of other different people, including his favorite Hindi movie star, who he's kind of named the virus after this woman, Leela Zahir, and he's
she dances on the
yes, and she's it's sort of embedded in or attached to pictures of her, or the promise to the unwary downloader is that you're going to get a picture of her, and what you in fact get is a lot of trouble. So it brings her in, and this whole business of kind of cultural transmission and the spread of ideas and the spread of images and the spread of... I'm very interested in the way that Indian cinema has kind of gone global.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but I thought you should tell them what your website is like.
Somebody made me...
I was really quite frightened when I...
Several people have said that. Yeah. I can't really... Sorry. So, I mean, in the book, there's a little dancing... animated GIF figure that is the sort of front for all this nasty stuff happening on your computer. But somebody made me a nice little Indian dancing girl for my website, and I seem to have panicked various people who think that I'm just playing some sort of sick joke.
But she is a very good dancer, your little woman, yeah. But I was going to ask you about the influence of film. I mean, it's clear in both of these novels, really. And you use it in very, very clever and interesting ways. So I just wanted to know.
I mean, I think it's sort of inevitable. I mean, I'm in my mid-30s, and I just think in terms of sheer numbers, the sheer volume, in terms of the amount of narrative that one gets through film and the amount of narrative one gets through text, you just... you see more films than you read books on the whole. I mean, taking an hour and a half, 2 hours worth of a story arc, and so there's a kind of filmic quality that I notice in almost all writers of my kind of age. But with the first book I wrote, The Impressionist, I mean, one which is set in India in the 20s, there's a bit of that that's a very direct riposte to particular film genre in that where I grew up, suburban London, the primary images of India in the 80s when I was a teenager were Merchant Ivory movies, where these very kind of lush landscapes of India, peopled by speaking white characters and silent and rather decorative Indian characters. And it was the kind of movies where if you needed an Indian in a lead role, you got Alec Guinness and you blacked him up rather than hiring any actual Indian people. Even when I was too young to really kind of understand the politics of that sort of thing and the kind of imperial nostalgia that they were selling to everybody in Thatcher era Britain, there was something very uncomfortable about always feeling that you're being represented by the guy with the tray with the drinks on at the back, and so I kind of really wanted to write one of a really self-consciously lush, luxurious, exotic Indian novel and just chop the legs off it.
Would you mind reading the first paragraph of that?
No.
Because you get started in just that way, and then you make sure by the end of the first paragraph you've made your point.
So the book begins in a sort of full-on luxurious way. One afternoon, 3 years after the beginning of the new century, red dust, which was once rich mountain soil, quivers in the air. It falls on a rider who is making slow progress through the ravines which score the plains south of the mountains, drying his throat, filming his clothes, clogging the pores of his pink, perspiring English face.
Yeah. There. So we know it's not Merchant Ivory by that point.
That's true. And in a way, that's the constant kind of push-pull in that book. I mean, I think a lot of people... I mean, the publisher, I thought this was a terribly canny move, that in a way, the kind of audience for a straightforwardly lush bit of Indian exoticism, were attracted to that, and maybe got part of the way through until they when they realised that that wasn't maybe quite what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, and of course, like Merchant Ivory, using that canon of ink lit that's very wrapped up with images of India and the European figure going to the exotic East and having a set of experiences which in some way make him, and it's usually a him, more aware of his own self and his own, in particular his own Englishness, often.
Now, the both the hero of the Impressionists and the hero of Transmission go through lots of adventures, that some of which they will and some of which they don't will. But they are ciphers in a way. I mean, they're trying on different identities, and of course, the very title of the Impressionist suggests that.
Which is a terrible title to have chosen in many ways, because it turns out it's almost untranslatable into any other language.
Really?
To everybody else, the Impressionist is just a
painter.
Member of a French art movement. Whereas the notion of somebody who's actually kind of performing a role or kind of putting something on, which is, and also in taking an impression, and this character is a very blank character who takes the stamp of whatever environment he finds himself in. So it works in English, but it doesn't work at all in other languages.
But it works for the characters because they survive because they can blank out whatever they were and then go on, it seems.
Yeah. That's something I've always been very interested in. This business, I mean, Selford in the novel and Selford more widely, I think there are certain conventions that are quite comforting conventions about representing what it is to be a person. Often centering around a notion of continuity or staying the same through all circumstances.
Yeah.
Traditionally we think of people having souls. I mean, the immutable essence of the person who, which won't be changed by whatever vicissitudes they experience. But in an age where perhaps we don't have an automatic belief in this sort of metaphysical essence of personality, how far can we say that we're continuous throughout our lives? Just as a thought experiment, really, knowing that that every one of us changes slightly given different social circumstances, I mean, especially in class-ridden Britain, you're always hearing people slightly modulate their accent depending on whether they're talking to their plumber or being introduced to the Queen. And that kind of thing intrigues me about where the limits of that might be. If you've got a character who was very blank and was interested in passing in any situation, where would the limit? Where would you be forced to stop in your changing? Could you kind of mutate completely?
Mm.
And it's a very scary set of thoughts in a way. I mean, you wonder what possibilities you contain within yourself. That kind of, I'm a nice guy, but could I be a murderer? If I went somewhere else or certain things happened.
But you're very much, I mean, although you do interesting things with the idea of selfhood and suggest interesting things through the trajectories of your characters, you are always talking about these people, thinking about their place in the world, and that opens up another whole unsettling sort of string of questions.
I mean, I think it does come down to this idea of networks and people as kind of existing at the intersection of all sorts of lines of force, people are being constructed by these huge sort of social and political and cultural and technological forces and biological forces which are beyond their control, and which out of which somehow a sort of sense of being a person emerges. But I always feel that kind of, maybe getting back to my Warwick days, Cartesian sense of the self as a sort of bounded thing that's never really rung very true. You feel like you're kind of crossed by lots of things, and that you could be kind of deformed or moulded by all sort of various sort of combinations, quite complex combinations of forces. And I'm interested in character in that sense.
And Everything you just said about character, in that sense, you could also say about your interest in language and the games that you play with language, because you can write in almost, you can write in any style you want, can't you?
Thanks for saying that. I mean, I do like playing with different registers of language. I suppose the story I read out is me fooling with kind of corporate brochure speak and horror.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how much moral corruption can be hidden under a sort of bland bland veneer of corporate speak? I mean, that's, I suppose, the origin of that's in one of these Wired-related situations where I was sitting next to a sort of senior American staffer on the magazine. I think he was a business development guy, but he was talking about the business of public relations and things. Imagine if you were the guy who had to deal with Bhopal. You know, how would you spin that one positively? And I was thinking, hang on, wouldn't you just admit that you did a terrible thing and maybe compensate the people? No, of course not. Duh. You know, you try and make the corporation look good. And the kind of sort of absence of empathy, you know, and the kind of the very sort of blinkered way he was approaching that has really sort of stuck with me as a particular. And that kind of view of how you should approach the world is something that we see increasingly in our public life.
Yeah, language permitting that view.
And language euphemisms and WMD, weapons mass destruction. It's kind of, you know, it could be anything, couldn't it? It could be something you buy at Burger King.
It probably will be. Yeah, right. I was wondering if any of you have any questions. Oh, no hands. This is one hand. Thank you.
It just might be me, but I think the story you read was one of the funniest pieces.
Thank you.
You mentioned my questions to the registers. You mentioned the horror and the speed. I was constantly reminded of the cyberpunk common view from benefit.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as a kind of contemporary novelist, you know, what your publisher definitely wants is for you to kind of mark out a nice bit of territory and, you know, deliver again and again. And it just sort of doesn't work that way, does it, really, when you're making what you want to make? I mean, all those writers that you mentioned are writers that I like. A lot, and I actually read that story out in a kind of two-hander thing with David Mitchell, and it was great. You know, all the things that we were talking about really, you know, bounced off each other. But in a way, I suppose you could see the impressionist as doing history or performing a certain kind of historical sweep, which has become such a sort of genre and such a, you know, it's crossed that line into being a kind of slightly hackneyed sort of known mode of writing. There's a pomposity that comes with it. There's a kind of romance. There's a vocabulary that insists on lots of sort of specifics. And, you know, and I in that book, I kind of try and crank that up to 11, and it is a very confected, self-conscious kind of history. And I mean, I think people who dislike the book have often sort of got that and not seen it as a good thing, and you just seen that it's lacking a certain sort of sincerity that some people want in order from, but which was very definitely what I wasn't trying to provide by fooling with this. And it seems important to do that with India in particular, because India is the exotic east and is this kind of place of sort of, you know, this place of dreaming where even the poverty is kind of excessive. People always come back from their gap year trip to India and you know, and then they have some sort of slightly hyper-real notion of the abject otherness of India, and I kind of, you know, pushing all that into a sort of slightly absurd, frenetic mode seemed like a useful thing to do. But I suppose it's all, yeah, it's all kind of performance, it's all ventriloquism and impressionism. Well, this might sound slightly cynical, but I mean, my travel writing career came about at least partly or largely with the discovery that there were PR people who you could ring up and they would give you free flights to places, and all you had to do was write a kind of what I did on my holidays essay. And I mean, I think newspaper travel pages are a very troubled kind of journalism, and I did quite a lot of it in you know, for those slightly dubious reasons earlier on, and then I realised that's quite how much of a sort of branch of public relations they are, and they're not a place where you can write in a certain kind of critical mode.
No, like, there are no politics.
Yeah, I mean, that travel prize actually was a very hokey Observer competition where you wrote a little, it was an open competition, you wrote a little tiny thing, and then they winnowed it down to five of us, I think. And then they sent us all to New Zealand on a kind of young person's bus tour, which is like, I mean, it almost designed to make sure that you didn't get anywhere near anything real. And it was a tie-in with the New Zealand Tourist Board and the New Zealand Flag Airline. And they had a prearranged deal that they would be able to use whatever piece won in brochures for the country. So there was a definite sense that what was going to be produced was going to be, you know, the wonderful glories of the mountain as I jumped off it on my bungee. And unfortunately, what they got from me, I mean, they were foolish enough to send me to a bit of North Island, New Zealand, where they had the treaty grounds where they'd signed the treaty with the Māori. And I'd run into some Māori people, and basically I got off the bus. and I wrote a piece which was about New Zealand's troubled kind of race politics, and they didn't want to see that. But there was a very weird sort of split decision, and it went 3-2 in my favour, and they gave me the prize, which is very nice, and I got a ticket back to New Zealand. And the people from the New Zealand Tourist Board were not happy about it, and they didn't speak to me at the prize ceremony, and there was a very weird atmosphere. And you know, more recently, the last travel piece I wrote was a kind of why I'm not going to the Maldives travel piece, which with any luck should be in next week's Observer if they're not too scared that they'll lose the Maldives account. Because everybody always writes these kind of wonderful, you know, I had a lovely time on the beach in the Maldives pieces, and nobody ever writes about the really appalling human rights abuses that are going on there, and the fact that the tourist industry is very, very tied up with all of that. And it's one of those places that there's a really kind of grim behind the scenes. And so I managed, you know, I've offered them this piece, and they've said they'll run it, and they've just sent back an unbelievably long list of lawyers' queries. Can I really prove that a certain person was sexually abused in the detention centre? And anyway, so it might run or it might not, but the travel pages are hard if you want to do proper writing, but they're good for getting free holidays.
Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, you got the Jonathan Aitken gag. Well, yes, I mean, that phrase about the trusty shield of fair play has gone into the language as a piece of hypocrisy, and so I borrowed it not really with the expectation that if it was read in 10 years it would still have a resonance, but it for the moment there's that echo of him, who I was lucky enough to have tea with, quite by accident. At the Hay Festival, I was put in the same bed and breakfast as Jonathan Aitken, and he had no idea who I was and wouldn't really speak to me until. And then he asked me how many copies my books had sold, and I told him, and he seemed to think it was then worth having a conversation with me. He's a,
but he's found God now, hasn't he?
Absolutely, but I don't know whether God's quite found him.
Up at the top there, yeah.
What always interests me, pretty much the same as you, when you're sitting in on a seminar and you're hearing this, is the truth has no place there. And also for memory. Memory does not allow any access because that would, you could learn from the memory. You could think, well, we're not very speedy over the way to work. What role does memory have in your thoughts?
That's one of those that sort of big questions. I mean, with the Impressionist, it's about a character who self-consciously attempts to escape what he's been before, and he reinvents himself again and again each time, sometimes involuntarily, but mostly voluntarily, attempting to distance himself from any kind of continuity in any kind of history. And I give him a kind of redemption at the end of the novel where he's marked in a permanent way on his body, and ever afterwards, my thought is, I don't run with that in any way, but my thought is that if you have a mark that came at a particular time in a particular place, a brand or something like that, you're then somehow anchored to that place, and whatever kind of denials you might have, that would be one way of fixing you in relation to memory. I mean, corporate memory is another thing. I mean, in this largely, as you say, is something that corporations don't have, except in a highly selective way. And it seems that, you know, that's one of, I mean, maybe that's one of, it's one of the way the internet does two things. I mean, it allows people to dredge up memory. Other people or corporations or whatever would want buried, so you can research and find out all the things that have happened, because that information will be there. But at the same time, it's very unfixed, and it is shifting. And you know, I kind of get emails from other writers sometimes, and in the moments of pomposity, I think, you know, were we all 200 years ago, we'd be writing each other letters, and they would be objects, and they would survive, and perhaps a conversation that I was having with somebody else about our writing would serve to kind of illuminate the novel or whatever, and you know, to somebody else. But all this is on email now, and it's all going. I mean, apparently I was talking to some librarians recently. It's a hot topic, and in librarian circles, it's, you know, archiving, electronic archiving, and how you keep memory alive in a world with no paper, no sort of physical text.
Yes.
I think it's quite obvious you are a really original writer.
Thanks, mate.
And if you do an original voice, I guess I just want to demonstrate that every young writer, aspiring writer, wants, which is how did it happen? Like a white man matches you, wake up in the morning, you know, stop and travel, and think, oh, why? I've got something. Didn't have a passion.
Well, I mean, I wanted to be writing fiction before I got involved in journalism, and there's a, you know, there's, I could tell a big sort of self-serving my years of toil kind of story. So that's definitely, well, it didn't feel like it was overnight, because there were two full novel manuscripts that I wrote in which I couldn't get anybody to read. And thank God, because neither of them were any good. But the, you know, it was, I mean, it was in a way, I was very lucky in that I appeared to arrive sort of with the Impressionist in a relatively formed way, with a sort of set of concerns and an evolved style, but that was something that had been worked on in private for, you know, years. So yeah, very much not overnight. No, I mean, no one's like that, and other than certain kind of weird autodidacts.
Yes, over here.
It It was that book began with Arjun, the Indian computer programmer, and Guy, who's the guy who runs a branding company, and I didn't really know how they would be connected, and I thought, and they didn't seem to have any obvious connection with one another. They didn't exist in the same place, because it was obvious to me that Arjun was in India and then America, and then Guy was in London. And so then I had this situation where I thought I had two characters who are in the same book, and they're not geographically in the same place, and that then suggested the whole business of link. You know, how would you tell a story where your central characters maybe don't meet? They don't ever. I mean, all the central characters in this book are never actually in a room at the same time, and that I think it kind of came out of that. So I definitely knew that politically I wanted to talk about something to do with corporations and banality and surface and a culture that skates across the surface of things and has a problem with depth, and also about globalization. So I mean, that's probably enough politics for a small book. So yeah, that's the kind of way that one started.
Any other question up there? Okay.
I think the Indians are already here, really, aren't we? I think the Indians are already here. I mean, I think in global economic terms, the real question for Britain is much more to do with Chinese manufacturing, I think, than necessarily Indian technical skills. I mean, China and India are growing at such a rate that I think the British conception of the world has been formed from in a manner where we've kind of got used to being second to the Americans, and that was sort of hard and bitter, and Suez is 50 years ago now, and people are still sort of feeling quite post Suez in this country. And we just got over that, and I think that the Asian boom is going to pretty much roll over Britain in a way which people in ways that people don't understand. And so, and things like Bollywood cinema and the kind of cultural the idea that there's a culture from Asia that's being sold into here and will be perhaps as strong a force as Hollywood is in the future. I mean, I think it's quite hard to imagine a world where what that world will look like. But I think that world is a serious possibility. I think we'll become very Asian in this country in ways that we don't appreciate yet. Well, they had a big currency crisis, didn't they? I mean, I think it's a world of global ebbs and flows and kind of, you know, sudden booms and sudden catastrophic busts. I think volatility is going to be another feature of our future, and whether that means events, unexpected events of all kinds, physical and cultural and economic, are going to characterize the near future.
Yep. All of these trends that you've been discussing also affect publishing, the media, and you've touched on that a little bit. I forgot to mention there was a prize you turned down, wasn't there?
I turned down a prize called the John Llewellyn Rees Prize, and I turned it down, which was a prize that Transmission was awarded, and I turned it down because the sponsor was the Mail on Sunday newspaper. And I would not have felt like a decent human being shaking the hand of the editor of the Mail on Sunday as if uh, I I grew up in Essex in the 1980s, and the Mail was in a very real way the bane of my life. I mean, the Mail made me feel like I wasn't welcome, and like I shouldn't, I didn't have the right to walk the streets of my own neighbourhood, and I'm very angry about that still, and the chance to stick two fingers up to them in public was just a godsend, really.
Well, not many people turn that down, but you give the impression that you can understand the corporate nature of publishing now in the media and hold your own. I mean, the story you told about the travel writing is again. But it is very, very difficult, and I was just wondering what your advice might be for new writers who are going to have to go into this.
I think it's much easier if you have a kind of base outside it, and I was lucky enough. You mentioned in your introduction that I'm involved with a magazine called Mute, which is a thing that most people won't have heard of because it's a very tiny publication that a group of us run, some people from a kind of art school background and some people from other kinds of backgrounds, have run since 1995, and it's a publication that at one point looked like a kind of parody Financial Times and has been a magazine and is now in the process of dissolving completely into various sort of online things and a print-on-demand operation. But it's a place where we've been able to publish mostly non-fiction writing, in fact, overwhelmingly non-fiction writing, which comes from a completely non-commercial perspective, a very critical perspective about technology and social change. And it's often quite obscure stuff. I mean, and if you're not... some people I give copies of it to can't get a kind of handle on it at all. But those people are kind of my gang, and we've got links into the social movements and a kind of world that's very much outside mainstream corporate publishing. And so when I got that the Impressionist published, that was a very weird moment because I was suddenly stepping into this properly commercial arena, which a lot of my friends basically disapproved of. There were mutterings of Faust, so I've had to kind of negotiate. I had to really ask myself hard questions because my friends in the pub were going like, "Who are you really? What do you want out of that? What kind of work are you trying to do by going into sort of mainstream publishing deal?" And I think for anybody starting out, if you have a kind of sense of where you are in the world, and then you approach an environment where you're having to negotiate with a company, whether that's a newspaper or a publishing company or a TV station or any other kind of outlet in which your creativity or your thoughts are being packaged for consumption, then you'll actually know, you'll know when it feels wrong, and you'll know which, because there are an infinite number of petty battles you could fight. I mean, the number of bad covers that I've seen put on my books that I slightly wince at, and the quotes plastering the cover of that I see no point having quotes on the cover of a book. I mean, but those kind of things, there are some things that are worth fighting and there are some things that aren't, and you know which ones to choose and you know who you are, hopefully.
Yeah, so if you know who you are and know where you stand on things, then
you're in a position to maybe keep your soul a bit.
Yeah, that's all. Are there any other questions before we draw to a close? Any? No? Yes?
You have to keep your fingers crossed. Mira Nair, who directed Monsoon Wedding and Salaam Bombay, among other things, has bought an option, and there's money, because Fox Studios, now there's a corporate connection. Fox Studios have offered a gazillion quid to Mira to make the movie, on condition that the script is right, and the right stars are attached to the project, and therein lies a world of pain. Funnily enough, You know, Sir Anthony Hopkins. You know, more or less, if we could get Keira Knightley to play all the roles, then we're you know, we are green lit. So I don't know. I reckon it's at the moment better than 50% chance. Mira's quite good at dealing with the heavies from the studios, and I think she could even make a good movie out of it. I'm not writing the script or anything. I'm giving it to her and allowing her to make her film out of it, and maybe she will.
And if she does, then you'll both come back and tell us about it.
Yes? Yeah, she's okay. We do quite a good double act, actually. She gives good speech, Mira.
Good, done deal then. Mm. Thank you very much for coming here this evening, Harry. Looking forward to seeing you with the film. Mm. Thank you for being a lovely audience. I have to tell you that the bookshop is doing 2 books for £10 offer, special offer this evening. So, and they're right outside. So we're corporate too, and we'll be all corporate together. And please applaud our guest. Thank you very much.